here. When I was young and stupid, in my early 20s, I thought I knew pretty much everything there was to know about parenting. And then I got married and I started having kids. And a year or so after that, I knew everything there was to know about parenting. And then I had another kid. And then those children started to get a little bit older. And before too long, I started thinking, you know what? Maybe I don't know everything about parenting. And here I am as the parent of two teenagers, about to be the parent of one teenager. And I come to realize I don't think I know anything about parenting. And it's kind of disconcerting. Because I actually find myself in opposition. I find myself in a position where I have far more advice to give on the subject of parenting than I ever have before. And I am in a position where that advice might actually be listened to by somebody. And I am less inclined to give advice than I ever have been in my life. Which isn't saying much, actually, because in previous times in my life, I was very eager to give advice, whether I knew what I was talking about or not, parenting or some other subject. And so when I broached the subject of possibly teaching a lesson on parenting, I got a good response from that, and so I thought I'd go ahead and do that. And I was trying to think if there was some kind of way that I could impart whatever kind of judgment that I might have without looking like I am just giving advice, without looking like I'm just telling you how I think you ought to be running my families, because I've been here for over 3 years now, and I've spent a good bit of that time telling you I have no intention of telling you how to run your families. So I don't want to give the impression that I'm going back on that. And so I scratched my head for a little bit, and I thought, maybe what we could do is this. Maybe we could just look at some stories from the Bible, some examples of parenting that we see in the text, and take from those stories some little tidbits of knowledge that probably are relatively common sense. And these points are not intended to tell us about how to parent by any means. That's not the main point of any of these things. But there are certain historical facts that are relevant. There are certain attempts that clearly failed or clearly succeeded. For better or for worse, most of the stories about parenting in the Bible are bad stories. That's just kind of the way it is. Take from that what you will. But maybe we can just look at these stories and use those as opportunities to talk about how all of us, including the parent of two teenagers, how we might be able to improve a little bit and be more God-centered and God-like and godly in our behavior as parents. For those of you who are parents, I hope that you take very careful note. Also, be aware that we're being talking in some pretty broad generalities here. So broad, in fact, that I can pretty much guarantee that if you are a parent at some point during the lesson here, probably in multiple points, you're going to be thinking that I'm talking about you. That's because these are going to be covering topics that all parents have to deal with. And I think that probably all parents in the room, including this parent, can use some advice and can use some instruction with regard to these things. So don't think that you're being singled out any more than anybody else is. We're all in this together. We're all trying to help each other do a little bit better at a task that sometimes might seem impossible. But in reality, it's like anything else we're doing in God's service. If we do it according to God's rules, if we do it God's way, then we may find ourselves meeting with a great deal of success. If you're not a parent, or at least not yet a parent, don't fall asleep on me. This is not something that you can just tune out on, because quite likely you will be a parent one of these days. And like anything that you find in the Bible, there's going to be some instruction there for you as well. Anyway, no particular order. Here are the lessons that I had in mind. First of all, the first lesson that I would like to suggest to you is that you need to discipline your children. And that may be we might as well start with the tough stuff, I guess. In Ephesians chapter 6 and verses 1 through 4, the text tells us here, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. I suspect that some of the kids out there may have heard this verse once or twice in Bible classes, especially around the dinner table. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, so that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. Kids, if you want to interpret that passage as saying, my mom and dad are going to kill me if I don't do better, you just go right ahead and interpret it that way. That's not too far wrong in the Old Testament context anyway, and whether it's true in your own family, that's none of my business. Anyway, verse number 4. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. That's the way the New American Standard Bible reads here. The discipline and instruction of the Lord. Discipline is not something that we especially enjoy giving, and it's certainly not anything that we enjoy receiving. But nevertheless, this is part of our role. It's a significant part of our role as parents. And the example that I would choose to give is maybe the most basic of all parenting relationships, and that's a relationship between God and us. We read a few moments ago in Hebrews chapter 12 about the parenting that God does for us and how we need to be able to receive discipline, and that is used in this immediate context, the parenting that we have as children, the parenting that we received as children when we were children. This is used as an example of how God is going to be disciplining us. And I kind of like to reverse that a little bit here today and talk about the discipline that God shows us and see that as a demonstration of how we are supposed to be disciplining our children. God is training us. That's what discipline is in this context. He's trying to train us because we are not instinctively godly people. We are not instinctively righteous people. God is trying to teach us how to be righteous, and left to ourselves, we're going to go in the wrong direction. And so God is there with a gentle nudge, or maybe a little bit more than a gentle nudge, trying to get us to go in the right kind of direction. We are going to have to be taught. We're going to have to be trained to do this. And that same principle applies when we are training or disciplining our children. And if we are not going to discipline our children, the text is really pretty clear and pretty ugly, frankly, about this. Notice in verse number 7 and 8. It is for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? This is a natural thing, or should be, anyway, a natural thing for parents to do with their children. Now, I realize that's not necessarily a popular position in the modern day. It may not be a popular position in your home. But nevertheless, this is the rule that God has laid out for us. And the consequences of the opposite are seen in verse 8. For if you are without discipline, of which you have all become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Now, he's talking here specifically about our relationship with God. The reason that God works so hard with us, the reason that he disciplines us, is because he has an investment in us. Because we are family. We are his children. We bear the name of his son. As we live lives here on earth, he has an inheritance that is waiting for us, and we have to be found worthy of that inheritance. And since he loves us, and again, discipline in this context is an extension of love, it is not contrary to love. Since he loves us, he is trying to help us be more like we ought to be. We will not get there on our own. We require God's discipline. And again, reversing the logic a little bit and applying that to our families. If I have a household where there is no discipline, if I have a household where there is no rules, where, as the saying goes, the inmates are running the asylum, the kids are doing just basically whatever they want to do, and maybe there might be some general kind of overlaying, you know, don't play in traffic, or try to eat your vegetables when you're given them, or try not to, you know, beat up your brother too bad, or, you know, things like that. There may be some general rules, but when you get specific about no, and we all know our favorite commandment from the parents, right? You do this, why do you do this? Because I told you to. That's what the parents do. That's what the parents tell the kids. You do this because I told you to. Because I said so. And we teach the children, in the first place, that they do not know best. In fact, they don't know anything. You know, lots of times we use the word precocious when we need to use the word bratty or know-it-all or whatever you want to do. If you have a four-year-old, who thinks he's a 16-year-old, the 4-year-old needs to be corrected. The 4-year-old is not a 16-year-old. If you have a 12-year-old who thinks she's a 20-year-old or he's a 20-year-old, that child's wrong. That child needs to be corrected. And it may be an ugly kind of thing. It may be a harsh kind of thing that nobody especially enjoys on the giving end or the receiving end. But nevertheless, we know as adults, or certainly we ought to know, that our child is not what he or she needs to be. And if they are going to honor our name, if they're going to be a partaker in our family, they need to be taught the truth. And sometimes taught the truth at the end of a stick. The child's not going to enjoy that. We're not going to enjoy that. But nevertheless, this is part of the discipline process. And it's a testimony that we love our children, that we are willing to do this. And the children do far, far better when they have rules, when they have guidelines, when they have limits that they know they have to respect, and there will be consequences when they don't. More on the consequences in a little bit. Are we trying to make adults out of our children eventually, is the question I ask, or are we just trying to make them happy where they are? And I think lots of times when we say we're trying to make our kids happy, what we mean by that is we're trying to make ourselves happy. You know, if the kids are happy, then they're going to leave me alone. If the kid gets ice cream when he asks for ice cream, then I get to watch my TV show in peace. That's what we mean lots of times, I think, when we're talking about making the kids happy. We mean making ourselves happy. Well, let's just bypass the entire thing. My children are here, and they will testify to the truth of this fact. The fact is, I don't especially care whether my children are happy. Okay? It'd be nice, all things being equal. I'd rather them be happy than be sad, I suppose, if I had to choose one or the other. But that's not really relevant to my role as parent. It's not what I'm all about. I'm not trying to make them happy. I'm trying to make them Hammondses. I'm trying to make them worthy of the name they are given. And especially as we walk with Christ, as they learn how to be Christians, I'm trying to get them to be worthy of that name. And it does not come instinctively to them. They're good kids, don't get me wrong. But they need to be trained. They need to be disciplined. And I need to find a way to do that. I need to find a way to show them the right way in which they should walk. Now, I talked a little bit about consequences. Let's talk about follow-through. In 2 Corinthians chapter 13, and verse number 1 through 4, Paul talks about follow-through in a different sort of context, not talking about parenting, but talking about his work with the Corinthians there. Paul writes here in verse number 1, of 1 Corinthians 13, "This is the third time I'm coming to you. Every fact is to be confirmed by the testimony of two or three witnesses. I have previously said that when present the second time, and though now absent, I say in advance to those who have sinned in the past, and to all the rest as well, that if I come again, I will not spare anyone, since you are seeking for proof of the Christ who speaks in me, and who is not weak toward you, but mighty in you. For indeed he was crucified because of weakness, yet he lives because of the power of God. For we also are weak in him, yet we will live with him because of the power of God directed toward you." Now, for our purposes, what we're saying is this. Paul has visited with the Corinthians. He helped some of them come to the knowledge of the truth, and he left. And then he wrote them a letter, at least one letter, quite likely two. And then he wrote them this other letter. And all of it in preparation for him coming to visit. And he told them in the first letter, he told them again in the second letter, things need to be set right by the time I get there. There are things going wrong that need to be going right. And one of these days, and not too long, I'm going to get there. And then we're going to see if things are set right. And if they haven't been set right before, they're going to be set right when I get there. And now we don't have any record of Paul actually, I take that back. Paul's interaction with the Corinthians is not detailed for us, exactly how all of this worked out, exactly what the back and forth was between Paul and the Corinthians here. But what we can have confidence in is that Paul had every intention not only of telling his spiritual children, as it were, what they needed to do in the faith, but also to follow up with them and made sure that they did the right thing. The example that I want to give with regard to parenting along these lines is with regard to a judge and priest named Eli that we have record of in the first few chapters of 1 Samuel. Eli had sons, at least two sons named Hophni and Phinehas. And the text seems to indicate that these are the only two. I couldn't confirm that they're the actual only two sons, but the only ones we hear about. And these two sons were kind of disgraceful. to this good man, this holy man, Eli, who was trying to do the right thing. And he had these two sons, and we're not going to get specific about the depravity that they were engaged in, but it was pretty grotesque. Let's just put it that way. They were not behaving as young men should. And we say young men, exactly how old they are, we don't know. They very well may be in their 40s or 50s, actually. I get used to thinking of them as teenagers, but they may not be teenagers. Younger than Eli, anyway, younger than their dad. And he maintains a relationship with them as they serve as priests with him, but don't serve faithfully. They're described in the text as being worthless men and how they did not know the Lord. I've commented before how the Old Testament really doesn't go out of its way to pass judgment on people oftentimes. Usually, it just tells a story and that's it. But here, the inspiration makes very specific here what's going on. They are worthless men. These are bad guys. And Eli knows about it. The text says that he chastises them about it in 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 23 through 25. In fact, if you look at that passage in isolation, it may seem like Eli is doing a relatively good job of parenting under unfortunate circumstances. Most of us who are parents have been in situations where we had to tell the uncomfortable truth. It may not have been taken all that well. It may have been rejected, in fact. But nevertheless, we did the best that we could. That sounds like what Eli is doing here. Eli says in verse number 23, he said to them, "Why do you do such things? The evil things that I hear from all these people. No, my sons, for the report is not good which I hear the Lord's people circulating. If one man sins against another, God will mediate for him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him?" But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for the Lord desired to put them to death. Now, there's a lot in that last phrase that we're going to bypass for our purposes here. But the point is, they listened to their father, and they may or may not have thanked him for his kind words, and then just did whatever they wanted to do. Well, what are you going to do? You know, fathers have a great deal of control over the children, especially when the children are young, but they don't have complete control. Ultimately, these boys are going to do their own thing. Surely Eli is absolved of responsibility here. Well, no, apparently not. Because we turn a page and look at chapter 3 and verse number 13, where God, speaking to Samuel here, Eli's successor, he says, "For I have told him," God has told Eli, that is, "that I'm about to judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knew, because his sons brought a curse upon themselves, and," notice this, "he did not rebuke them." That's the way the New American Standard Bible reads here. And now you may be thinking, well, it sure sounded like he rebuked them. Well, it does sound like he rebuked them. But clearly in the context, whatever we saw or read of Eli doing in chapter 2 was not adequate. God did not feel that he had gone far enough. And this is where we oftentimes find ourselves as parents. We give our children direction, and we're inconsistent with that. We don't follow up. We don't follow through. This is what you need to do. I'm really bad about this. This is a growth area for me. My children hope desperately that I do not grow in this area. But nevertheless, I'm going to try. You know, I tell the children they need to take the trash out, or they need to wash the car, or they need to learn how to cut the grass, or whatever it happens to be. And then I don't follow through. They don't do what I told them to do. I don't ask them if they've done what I've told them to do. Now, all of you are either children or former children, right? So you know how this works. If your parents tell you to do something, your instinct is that something you don't want to do, that is. They tell you to eat ice cream, you're probably okay with that. They tell you to do something you don't want to do. Your instinct is going to be to not do it and see what happens. And if nothing happens, well, it's all good, right? We just get to keep going the way we're going. And maybe next day or next week or whatever, dad's going to come back and remind, "Oh, that's right, I need to do that." And we won't do it that time either. And this will continue until the parent follows up to the extent that he gets the task done that he needs to get done. This is what God requires of parents, not just to let the children know what they need to be doing, but also to make sure that it gets done as much as we possibly can. Again, especially when you're talking about adult children and teenage children, the children have a mind of their own. There's going to be a limited amount of control that you have. But as you have control, exercise that control. I had a conversation with a parent of a 16-year-old. And my entire life, people have always told me that once your kid gets to be 16, you're going to lose control of your kids. You're going to lose all control. As no, I'm not. I'm going to gain control of my kids when they turn 16. 16 is going to be a great age, and it was. Because all of a sudden, you know what the magic number is for, you know, why 16 is such a special number, right? 16, they get the driver's license, right? All you have to do is take away the driver's license. They will do whatever you want them to do. Or threaten to take away the driver's license. They'll do whatever you want them to do. The idea that you can't exercise control over a teenager is nonsense. Of course you can. It's just a matter of will. Now, unfortunately, a lot of parents don't have the will. And my children have been pretty good as far as that kind of thing goes. I never even had to threaten, as far as I can remember, to take away driver's licenses. But that club was always there, and they knew it was always there. Because similar exercises of discipline had been shown in the past, and similar follow-through had been seen in the past. They know the dad's serious about this kind of thing. They know mom is serious about this kind of thing. The question is, are we trying to stop bad behavior, or are we just trying to be on the record? My kids know how I stand about drinking. They know I oppose that. You know, but you know what? They're going to do what they're going to do. At least I can go to bed confident at 2 o'clock on a Saturday with my kids still out on the town doing whatever they're doing. I can be confident that I told them that drinking was bad. And if they decide to drink, well, that's just on them. Anybody want to parent that way? That's a recipe for disaster when you do that. That's just nonsense. Why would you do something like that? I'm interested in actually fixing problems, or avoiding problems even better than that. Now, I would like to be able to lay my head on my pillow in peace and stand before God and say, yes, I did say all the right things and do all the right things. But I'm accountable for my children's lives. I want more than just good words, good intentions. I want good results. And I want to behave in such a way that I will get the good results that I'm looking for. The third point is promoting spirituality. And I add the word really here because we're in close company here. If I were to ask all the parents here, are you in favor of valuing spiritual things over physical things as you exercise parenting in your household? I imagine I'd get pretty much 100% hand raises. Oh, sure, absolutely. Spiritual things come first. It's easy to say that in a church house. It's easy to say that when the preacher is staring you in the eye. The question is, are we actually going to do that in our everyday life? Are we actually going to behave in such a way that our children will know spiritual things are more important than physical things? And don't kid yourself about this. They know. Your kids are, you talk on and on about how smart your kids are. Let me tell you something, your kids are smart. As far as this kind of thing goes, values, priorities, they get that stuff right away. They know what's important. They know which TV show Dad absolutely refuses to miss. They know what ball team he roots for. They know why it's evil to root for this team and righteous to root for this team. They get all that. And they understand when mom and dad are being hypocritical about these things. They understand when we value baseball or value school or value whatever it happens to be over spiritual things. The example that I'm going to give here is Isaac and Rebecca. And I wish we knew more, well, I wish we knew more about all these stories, but especially about Isaac and Rebecca's parenting style, because Isaac and Rebecca were told from the very beginning which one of their children was going to be the righteous one, which one was going to be the not-so-righteous one, which one was going to be worthy of the family name, which one was not. And the children grow up over the next few decades, and turns out exactly the way God said. Esau turned out to be exactly what he was prophesied to be. Jacob turned out exactly to be what he was prophesied to be. And still, Isaac is determined to bless Esau against God's wishes, against any kind of spiritual value system. And why? Because Esau was a really good hunter. Because he cooked up a mean venison roast. Because he smelled like the wild. You know, whatever, however you want to phrase it here. It just looks dumber and dumber, quite frankly, as we look at Isaac's value system. Why in the world, not only are you choosing the wrong son, but you're choosing him for stupid reasons? We can be guilty of that same kind of stupidity, though. I don't know how many conversations I've had with parents over the years who are just as proud as they could be of their child who went off to such and such college and got such and such a job and is making all this money, and the subject of their faith comes up. Well, they're not really serving the Lord right now, but and try to get past that. And I understand that you don't want to dwell on the bad news. I get that. I'm not suggesting anything otherwise. But I would suggest to you this. It can get to the point where we are so excited about the positive things in our child's secular life that we turn a blind eye to their spiritual life. In fact, that we will deny them in the spiritual arena for the purpose of augmenting and supplementing their carnal arena. I have no issue with the kids getting good grades. I have no issue with your kid being an all-star or whatever it happens to be that you're striving for in carnal things, as long as it doesn't supplant spiritual things as the most important thing in your life. And again, the kids know when we're being hypocritical about this. Our choices that we're making here intended to improve our children's spiritual lives or improve their physical lives. Every choice I'm talking about, what they do for a living, where they go to college, certainly who they marry, who they date, absolutely. The choices that we make in the carnal arena are going to have some degree of implications in the spiritual arena, especially marriage, especially dating. Are we really going to act like it's better for my child to be married to somebody who's going to try to drag him to hell than not married at all? Well, at least I get the grandkids with the bad marriage. Well, it's not about the grandkids. It's not even about the marriage. It's about drawing closer to God and encouraging your children to draw closer to God. And when we make choices, when they are young, when they are teenagers, compromises, and we know they are. And by the way, let me interject here something. Virtually every congregation that I've been at, there have been a significant number of parents of kids from like 8 years old to maybe 14 years old who absent themselves, especially from Wednesday night, in pursuit of baseball or football or track or whatever it happens to be. And I have not noticed that at all in this congregation. I may have missed something here. Maybe I'm not paying as close attention to you as you think I am. But I have noticed instead a consistent pattern of people valuing what a lot of people would call to be optional. But it's not, hopefully, that we're on the same track with this. Hopefully, you're thinking like I am. When on a Wednesday night at 6:45, you're making a decision whether to stay for an extra inning and let your kid play another, maybe get another at-bat or whatever, or coming back to the church house and going to Bible class. It's not just a matter of whether the kid's going to go to hell because he misses one particular Bible class. That's not it. That misses the entire point. The point is, are we going to teach them that spiritual things matter? Or are we going to think that spiritual things matter unless something else more important matters? Now, I'm not suggesting, again, that parents are going to go to hell or their kids are going to go to hell because they make a choice like that on Wednesday night. But when we start establishing a pattern, when we over and over again emphasize to our children, yes, ordinarily we would do something spiritual, but we're not going to do something spiritual right now. We're going to do something else. When we teach them for 18 years, that ultimately spiritual things are going to have to be sacrificed for carnal things, they're going to learn that carnal things are more important. And when they leave the house, they're going to act like carnal things are more important. It just kind of stands to reason. I got one other point, if I remember right, and I want to make sure that I emphasize this. If this lesson goes over well, I may preach another one in a couple of weeks. If it doesn't go over well, I'm going to preach 8 more lessons on this. So be advised. One other point before we close today, though, I wanted to make sure that I talked about this. The idea of loving your kids, loving your children. Which seems to me as maybe not redundant exactly, maybe not pointless, but I don't know. I never had to be taught how to love my kids. At least I don't think I did. Maybe I was taught and I didn't realize it. But it seems to me that it was just the most natural thing in the world. Continues to be the most natural thing in the world to love my kids. And it's interesting that Paul writes to Titus in Titus chapter 2 about his instructions for older women. One of the things that he tells them to do in verse 4 is to encourage the young women to love their husbands and love their children. Now, love the husbands, that's a whole other sermon. Teach them to love their children. What does that mean? Well, I'm not sure I know exactly what that means. Maybe it means teach them to show that love in the way, like we've been talking about this hour. Maybe that's part of it. Maybe it's simply that your shows of affection toward your children are important, and you may not realize that they're important. You may not have time to hug your kids. You may not have time to tell your kids that you love them. Taylor and Kylie will tell you about this. When I would drop them off at school, usually I was the one to drop them off at school. And I made a point virtually every single time I dropped them off to tell them that I loved them. And it's not because I was afraid something's going to happen. It's some, you know, crazy man was going to come to school and kill everybody, and I wasn't going to get another chance to tell them that I loved them. It wasn't because I thought maybe they had not noticed before. That maybe somehow I've been imagining things all this time. And they may not know how they stand with me. That wasn't it at all. But I wanted that to be my last impression with them. I wanted them to go to school with that on their mind. And I'm sure they tune me out 99% of the time. And that's fine. But that 1% matters. And I'm not sure that you can tell your kids that you love them too many times. I'm not sure you can tell your wife either, or your husband. That's another subject again. Teach the young women to love their children. We see such horrible parenting examples in our society, especially in Hollywood these days, where it seems pretty obvious, not to judge terribly here, but it does seem on the surface that some people get kids because they want kids. Because, you know, all their friends are having kids, and the popular thing, my agent says that my Q rating is going to go up if I have kids, so I'll go out and get some kids. And I'll have some surrogate parent bear it for me, and I'll have a nanny raise them for me, and then I'll have the financial advisor pay for their college and all that kind of thing. And I'll just keep doing what I'm doing and not be bothered too much with all the minutia about actually loving my kids. And then, you know, once a day I'll come and hug them and tell them I love them, and then we'll be done. I suggest to you that's not the kind of loving our children that we need to be emphasizing. We need to delight in our children. We need to find ways of sharing quality time with them, connecting with them, taking pleasure in the fact that we are sharing a room at any given moment. Maybe, you know, we play a lot of board games in our house. Maybe you watch football. Maybe you go to movies or whatever it happens to be. Find a way to connect with your children. Because I guarantee you, they are desperate to connect with you. You don't have to teach children to love their parents. That's instinctive. Children in horrible situations with horrible parents love their parents. You've all heard the horror stories. Parents are the ones who need to learn. They need to learn how to love their children. The example that I'm giving is the prodigal that Jesus talks about in the parable in Luke chapter 15. And this marvelous example of father, who obviously stands as a representative of our heavenly father. The prodigal standing as a representative of someone who's wandered away from the faith. And you know the story. We aren't going to take time to go back and read the story. But this young man is ungrateful and unappreciative, and he's just going to take what's his, and he's going to scoot off, and he's going to do his own thing, and he's going to completely reject his father and completely reject his father's values and just absolutely break his father's heart. And although there aren't a lot of details given as far as the father's reaction to this, it's not too difficult to figure it out. I know it would crush me. I know it would crush you. But despite how absolutely unworthy this child was, his father still loved him. And we know that he still loved him because when the son finally comes to his senses and he comes back on the road, he is still afar off. And his father apparently is sitting there on the front porch or whatever the New Testament equivalent of a front porch would have been, looking down the road every single day perhaps. Maybe today is going to be the day my child comes home. Is that what you would do? Maybe not literally sitting on the front porch, but praying about it every day, thinking about him every day, Maybe today will be the day that they make their life right. And again, there's a certain amount of control that you lose, especially when the child gets to be an adult. They're going to have to make the choice here. Well, the young man did, in fact, make the choice. His father couldn't force him to repent, but what he could do is show absolutely unconditional love and support for him when he came back. I said we wouldn't read the story. Let's read the last part of it here. Verse number 22, the father said to his slaves, quickly bring the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet, and bring the fatted calf, kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and has come to life again. He was lost and has been found. And they began to celebrate. Let me ask you, do you think the father loved his son until his son messed up? And then he stopped loving him. And then when his son repented and came back, he started loving him again. You think that's the way this story goes? Because I don't think that. I'm quite confident the father loved his son at all times, like God loves us at all times. And he's just as desperate as we are for his wayward children to come home again. That love does not stop. And if God can have that kind of love for us when we are rebellious, and show that kind of love when we are rebellious, surely we can find a way to love on our kids. And especially the little ones. But you know, how do I say this without being too mean to my kids? When your kids are, you know, Grayson's age, when your kids are Caleb's age, it's relatively easy to love on your kids. You know, when your kids get to be 14, 15, 16, in the first place, they don't especially want to be loved on. Or at least they say that. Oh, Dad. And we give ourselves a pass, I think, maybe sometimes, in the expressions of love. Let's not do that. Let's continue to beat them over the head with love. Let's continue to endure the reproaches of the kids who say they don't want us to say that. Just ignore it. They like it more than they think they do. Show that love for your children. And then show it again tomorrow. Show it again the next day. Let your child be an absolutely no, and do not give yourself a pass on this. Do not assume that this is the case simply because the child hadn't taken out a knife in the middle of the night and ended everything. Okay, don't assume that. You make sure that your child knows exactly where he or she stands with you. I would like to think that that's an absolutely common sense kind of thing. Maybe it's not. If it is something that you haven't been doing, then by all means, fix that before it's too late. Do we delight in our children's presence? Or are we just seeing them as accessories? I went out and got a new car. Went out and got a new boat. Went out and got a new kid. You know, six of one, half dozen the other. I hope not. Because these are little lives that we're dealing with here. These are little souls that are placed in our custody. And if we can't manage to love them, then it really speaks pretty poorly about our opportunities to do anything more than that for them. Anyway, we're going to stop there and give you an opportunity to make your life right with God in whatever way may be necessary. I hope and pray this has been a complete and total exercise in, yeah, I knew that, here this evening. But there may be some aspect of your life that is not turned over to God. There may be every aspect of your life that's not turned over to God. And we're going to give you an opportunity to change that. We're going to give you an opportunity to commit yourself to God, to His things, to His ways, to His people. If you haven't been baptized in water for remission of sins and you're ready to do that, if you have been rebellious in some fashion and need the prayers and the encouragement of the brethren, then we offer that as well. Whatever we can do to help you walk with Christ more perfectly and hopefully secure for you a home in heaven after this life is over, please come and respond to the invitation while we stand.